Okay, let's get started here. So we have two more classes to go after today's class. So today I'm going to start, I will talk about DCOM and Genie. This is basically the last chapter of the book. And I will basically finish these two case studies today. So that still leaves us with two more lectures. I'm going to spend one class talking about sensor networks, and one class talking about either multimedia systems or mobile computing. I haven't decided which of the two. Okay, so these will be two of the more advanced topics that I had mentioned very early on when I gave you the outline of the class. Okay, and as far as the course is concerned, we have a project due next week. I hope you have started working on the last project. The programming assignment, that is, project is the same as the programming assignment. Okay. No one has asked any questions so far, so I don't know if this is good or bad. Either it's also crystal clear that there are no questions left, or most of you haven't started. I don't know which of the two. But do get started, because it's the last week of classes and you don't want too many things due at the same time. Okay, and then we'll have the final exam. So on the 22nd, as I had announced, so it will be a take-home. Okay, 24 hours. I'll hand it out on the 22nd in the morning. Well, I'll actually put it on the web page, so you don't have to come in to get it. You can just download it and then send your solution in by email. Okay. Some of you have come to me with conflicts, and I will make appropriate arrangements. If you have any conflict, another exam on the same day or at the same time or some such thing, do come and talk to me soon. I need to make sure I know what to do beforehand. Alright? So let's start with the DCOM. So this is the last of the middleware case studies. Okay, we did one on EJBs, we did one on CORBA. Then we'll do one on DCOM. So this is Microsoft's middleware. Okay, so it stands for Distributed Component Object Model. Okay, and it basically comprises of several pieces. There's something called COM. This is the component object model. Layered on top is something called OLE, or object linking and embedding. And layered on top of that is something called ActiveX. Okay, this is also the evolution of the technologies. Okay, so they had a RPC framework which they effectively called COM. And this was RPCs across objects on the same machine, entities on the same machine. And then they added some framework for linking objects and documents, as we'll talk about. Then this turned into ActiveX, okay, which turned into DCOM. And DCOM has now become .NET, so which we will not talk about, but that's the latest incarnation of all of this. Okay, so let me talk about these components a little. Okay. So DCOM is a successor to COM. Okay, COM itself was designed to support compound documents. Okay, so what is a compound document? So if you have a Word document and you embed, let's say, a graph from Excel, you know you can do that if you used Microsoft Office. Or you have a PowerPoint document and you also embed a Excel spreadsheet in there. Okay? Now this document has become a compound document because it has pieces of another document embedded in here that can be displayed. Okay? So COM was their basic technology framework to do this. Okay? So this allows Word documents or PowerPoint presentations to have Excel spreadsheets and so on. So that was the very basic framework they had, because they saw that Office users were increasingly trying to take pieces of one document, paste it into other, and reference them from another document. So this got generalized into a new technology called OLE, or Object Linking and Embedding. So what happened here was, so they took the COM layer and they replaced it with a more flexible layer. So rather than just embedding data, so rather than one application embedding data from another application, in this case, it was Microsoft Word embedding data from Excel, a chart from Excel and data from Excel, they allowed you to actually send messages. okay, which was a more general framework. So now one application could send message to another application. Okay, so any application that had exposed an Olay interface allowed another application to invoke it using a script or using anything like that. Now this is very similar to RPCs, but this was very much designed for Microsoft Windows and Windows technology. So they didn't actually support more general RPCs frameworks until much later. Okay. So there are many applications that now still have this Olay layer, and you can programmatically control that application through the Olay layer, because that's basically invoking RPCs on that application. And these could be applications as simple as Word, which you use normally. Okay, Word also would have an Olay layer, which allows another application to talk to Word, okay, a remote application to talk to Word. Okay. So that was basically the evolution. And then they basically added yet another layer on top of this, which was ActiveX. This allowed you to add scripting and several other components, like you could group controls. This added GUI frameworks that allowed you to talk to other applications and so on. So that was the ActiveX layer. Okay, and then they figured that maybe you need to allow this across machines, because all of this was really restricted to a single machine, one application talking to another application on the same machine. So they basically generalized this to have what is called DCOM, which had all of these, but it allowed you to do this across machines. Okay. That's the short history of DCOM. Okay, the more recent evolution has been .NET, which you probably have heard of. So .NET adds several things to this. Okay, .NET is all of this, but a lot more. .NET has a common language runtime. Okay? This allows objects written in one language to access objects written in another language. Okay, we talked about Korba is cross-platform, language independent, and so on. So the latest incarnation of all this, which is .NET, is also similar. Okay, so you can write a Java program and have it talk to a C or a C-sharp program, or a C-sharp object access C++ object. And the runtime makes all of this possible. It does the translation. It allows you to invoke methods, remote methods, on an application written in a different language. Okay? And then there are many other features of .NET. I mean, there is a GUI component, C#, which is basically derives inspiration from Java somewhat. And then there are all of these RMI type techniques, including object linking and embedding and so on. Okay? Is this clear? What we just talked about. Okay, so now let's go back. So that history, let's look at the object model and so on. Okay, so this should be very familiar by now. Okay, this is the same picture that we have seen when we did RPCs. Okay, so there is so DCOM has an IDL specification. So you have set of remote methods that you want to expose. You write a specification, and then you hand it over to an IDL compiler. Okay, this provides a binary interface with pointers. Okay. So what happens is each method basically becomes a function pointer. Okay, and there's a table of function pointers. And whenever a remote method is invoked, you basically dereference that function pointer and call the appropriate function. This is how the runtime works. Okay, that's that binary interface that we have seen there. Okay, the IDL compiler also generates prototypes. These are stubs. Right? So you could generate a C stub or a C++ stub or a Java stub, depending on what language you want to write your application. The same specification can generate these stubs in different languages. Then you take your application, link it to these stubs, use a standard compiler, and you generate object code. Okay, that actually runs. Okay, is this clear? What has happened here in the object model, how it works? Not very different from what we have already seen before. Okay. So some things are different from what we have seen before. Okay, this supports only binary interfaces, which means that basically you have a table of pointers to methods. These are function pointers that are dereferenced at runtime. Okay, some other things that are different are that all objects are transient. Okay, so there's no notion of having an object that you create and it sort of lives for the lifetime of the application. Objects come and go. Okay, maybe requests come in, you create a new object, you instantiate a new object on the fly, you populate it, and it processes the request, and then eventually it's deleted if there's nothing that is using the object. Okay, meaning is ref count goes to zero, meaning there's nothing in the system that is using the object, is automatically garbage collected. Okay. Now, because you have binary interfaces and pointers, like Korba DCOM also supports dynamic object invocation, which means when you write your application, you don't have to specify the method you are going to call. Okay, that can be dynamically decided at runtime, and the system is going to support that. We talked about this last time when we talked about Korba. The same feature is available in DCOM. Okay. Now there are so those were the differences, and then there are several other things that are similar, just with a different terminology. Okay, we have this thing called an interface repository. Okay, that is called a type library. Okay, this is effectively your naming service. Whenever you your application comes up, it registers itself. In this case, you would register yourself with a type library. So the type library is a repository or a database of all the methods that have been exported by any application. Okay, that supports DCOM. So whenever a client wants to bind to that server, it has to go look up the type library and say, where is a server that exposes this method or this interface? And then the type library will give you the necessary information, and then you contact that server. Okay. So then there is something called a service control manager. That's the implementation repository. That also tells you where the code is running. So that's basically a repository of all of the implementation. And then the rest of it looks very similar. There's a proxy and a marshaller. This is your stub. That's the comm layer that actually does the communication for you. And there is a similar thing on the server side. Yeah. And all of this is only runs on Windows. Yeah, so this is platform specific, although it doesn't have to be. Now, like Korba, DCOM also supports a variety of events and messaging features, which are basically based on the publish-subscribe paradigm. Okay, we talked about this last time, where there was an event channel that was the buffer. Okay, producers produce events or data that go into these buffers. Subscribers subscribe to this. Okay, we'll come back to this when we talk about Genie, and I'll show have more to say about it. Okay. The only thing to keep in mind is this event channel in DCOM is a persistent store. That's why you've shown a disk here. Okay? Events are put on the disk, and then some consumer can at some later time go and take delivery of the event. Okay? Now this is done using Microsoft's message queuing framework. Just as we talked about, IBM had this message queuing framework. Microsoft also has one of its own, and that is what is used to store this undelivered events on disk in a persistent form. Okay. So this also implies that this is persistent and asynchronous communication. Okay, it is persistent because the events are on disk, so they are not going to go away. It's asynchronous because the suppliers and consumers don't have to make blocking calls. They can just poll the event queue if there is an event of interest. Now this picture is very similar to what we saw when we looked at RMIs. Okay, if you remember the picture we had during RMI, there's a process that wants to access a server. Okay, this is a server. There are these two client applications. Okay, so the client can basically make a request on the object at the server. Okay, this is the object-oriented version of this. So this is the object stub. That's the object itself. Okay, object has methods and it has data. Okay. So when the client basically makes a call, you have to use the proxy to marshal and demarshal arguments, send a request to the server, and then other processes can make similar requests. Okay, nothing different about the way you invoke objects. But what is different is this feature called monikers. So this is as I said, all objects by default are transient, which means they have limited lifetimes. So long as something in the system is using those objects, the object is alive, otherwise it's garbage collected. Okay. Now that basically means if you want to keep any persistent state in your application, you can't use those default objects. Because if nothing is using it, if there's no client request, for example, that object will be deleted and so will its state. Okay. So if you want to keep persistent state, you need a different mechanism, okay, in the DCOM world. And that is done using this notion of monikers, which are effectively persistent objects. Okay. So what happens here is, this is an extension of transient objects. So only thing that is done is, if there is no reference to an object, like transient object, the object will be deleted in this case. But before doing so, you will take its state and you will put it on disk. Okay? And at some later point, if there is again a reference to the object, that state is recreated on the fly. Okay? So here are the steps that you have to basically go through in order to bring up an object. So here is a client that calls a method on an object. Okay? So to do that, you have to first call bind to look it up. And so you look up the repository, and then that will basically create a new instance of the object. Let's assume this is the first reference to the object after some point in time. Okay? So the object doesn't exist. So when you call it, it's recreated on the fly. So the system will do an equivalent of new and allocate space for the object and load the code. Okay, that's what has happened here. Okay. Now, if this object was ever present any sometime in the past, okay, it would have some state that would have been stored on disk. Okay. And then you have to reload that state from disk, okay, which is what has happened here. So you instruct the object to load previously stored state. So it will load its state from a disk. Okay. So this recreates the state that was present in the object. Okay. So basically what you have done is you have transient objects, but you persist the state across instantiations of the object by storing that state on disk and reloading the state from disk at the next instantiation. Yes, question.
Is it checkpointed also?
No, it's not checkpointed. So the basic idea is this. Right? So let's assume this is time. Okay. Let's suppose this is the first reference ever to the object. So the object is created here. Okay. It's going to do some computation, and let's assume at this point in time there are no more references to the object. But the object has some state that has gotten created as a result of processing some requests. Okay. Now, if there are no more references, DCOM is going to delete that object. It's going to garbage collect. But since this is a moniker, what it is going to do is it's going to take all of its variables in that object and it's going to store them to disk in a file. Okay, and then it delete the object. Okay. Now at some later point in time, let's say here, there's a new reference to the same object. Okay. Now there's no, the object doesn't exist at this point because you've deleted it. So you will again do new and create that object. Okay. At that point, you will go back and load the state. Okay. So now you have the same version of the object as it existed here. Okay. Now it's not checkpointed. You only do this across object invocations and deletions. So this is not meant for fault tolerance. Okay, it is just meant to persist state across multiple invocations. That's all that we are doing here. Is this clear? Any questions on this? This is something different. No other system does this. I mean, in CORBA you have persistent object, but the object always is persistent. Here it's sometimes in memory and sometimes on disk. Okay, this is equivalent to object being swapped out on disk. And then you swap it back, and that's the way to think about it. Okay, so there are different types of persistent objects that that DCOM supports. It's a file object. Okay, this is basically a container of data that's uninterpreted. So whenever the object goes away, data goes back to file. This is equivalent to memory mapping your file. Okay, so that's a file object. So you construct the object from a file. Could have a URL object. This is a class object. This is the most general version that actually has code and data. And then you could have composite objects where the object has some variant of these. And then you could have something called a pointer object and so on. Okay. So the last thing that is relevant to DCOM is the naming service. And here what DCOM uses is Active Directory. Okay, this is, if you remember the discussion on naming in chapter 4, we said that there is this thing called LDAP and every vendor has an implementation of LDAP, and we said Active Directory was Microsoft's LDAP implementation. Okay. So that's the same thing that is used by DCOM for any name service lookups and so on. And if you know anything about how Windows works, so the naming service itself is called a domain controller. Okay, this basically controls a domain. So just as you have a DNS domain, in the context of Windows, you can create a domain. So this is basically all the machines that belong to a organizational group, like your research group, or it could be the department. Okay. So for each of those domains, there's a domain controller. This is basically the server you go to do domain lookups. Okay, so you want to know what's the IP address of the machine, you'll go to the domain controller. You want to look up the password for a user, you would again go to the domain controller. Okay, and there's also this notion of a master domain controller and several slaves, right? Because this could be replicated for availability or performance reasons. And then the rest of it works the same way. You want to look up a machine, you go back to, so here you show that there is basically a DNS server and there is an LDAP server. Okay? So you would basically go and ask for the address of the domain controller from the DNS server. You would get the IP address of the domain controller. Then you would send the LDAP query to the domain controller and a reply would come back to you. Okay? And this LDAP query could be anything. It could be look up the IP address of a machine to what is the access control privileges that this user has to is what the password for the user if the user is trying to log in. So all of this same stuff that you have in any LDAP implementation is also supported in Active Directory. Okay? And Active Directory does more. It can be used to automatically push out software updates. Okay, so if you have machines, you probably know that whenever a patch is released, a machine actually goes and downloads it from server on the internet. Okay, and then you will apply that security patch or some other type of patch onto your machine. These are OS updates. Okay? In large organizations, so if you want to have more control over what patches are getting applied on what machines, you don't let machines go to a server on the internet. You have the machines talk to your Active Directory service. And the Active Directory service has policies which says who needs to get this patch, how do you roll it out, and so on. And it would then push out these. And it has complete knowledge of all of the machines in your organization, so you can define policies in this LDAP implementation as well. Okay? So it's a more general naming service than just being used for DCOM, but the interesting thing about DCOM is it just leverages a naming service that's already there. It doesn't have to define one of its own, which many other techniques don't do. Okay. So that's a very brief overview of DCOM. Okay, now I'm going to talk about distributed coordination and Genie, which is basically the last chapter of the book. So let me start with the motivation. Okay, so here we are assuming that what you want to design is what are called loosely coupled distributed systems. Until now, what we have looked at are systems that have more tight coupling between the various entities or between the client and the server. Okay? But there is a broad class of systems which we really haven't paid any attention to, okay, which communicate, but the coupling between any two entities that communicate is very loose. Okay? And I'll talk about what loose means in the next slide. Okay? And the question is, if there is very loose coupling, how do you coordinate activities within your distributed application or these entities? And that is done using what is called distributed coordination. And to understand this, we'll to look at what this slide is showing is various forms of interaction between distributed application. Okay. And to do this, so this picture, what it has shown is there are two dimensions here, two axes. This is interaction in the temporal dimension, okay, interaction in time, and referential is interactions in space. Okay. And within each, you could have coupled, tightly coupled or uncoupled, which means it's loosely or weakly coupled. Okay? So we'll look at each of these dimensions. So let's assume it's tightly coupled in time or space. This is called direct interaction. Okay? Example is face-to-face, where both parties are present at the same time, or instant messaging, okay, where both people are online at the same time and they're exchanging messages. Okay? So this is direct communication. Both the sender and the receiver are both online and they are sending messages. Okay? This is one form of communication. And then the other one is it's decoupled in time but coupled in space. Okay? And the mailbox is a good example. Email is one step down from instant messaging where you can send a message at any time but the recipient doesn't have to be online. It is going to be stored in a mailbox. The recipient can later take delivery. Okay? So it's decoupled in time because both the sender and the receiver are not online at the same time, which is why it's decoupled. But it's coupled in space, and what that also means is you know who you are sending the email to. Okay, you are basically sending the mail with the address of the recipient. Okay, and the mail gets delivered to that recipient's mailbox, and so the recipient will later take delivery of that mail. Now this one is, so now we'll look at the next two. So if you are decoupled in space but coupled in time, this is what is called meeting oriented. Okay, so this, think of a meeting room. So you know you have to attend this meeting at some point in time, let's say noon today. Okay, and you know where the meeting is being held. So it's at noon, so you know that, which is why it's coupled in time. So you just show up at that location. Okay? But you may not know who else is going to come to this meeting, okay? Which is why it's decoupled in the referential or the space dimension. Because some random set of people may show up. You don't know who exactly is going to show up. Class is a good example. Okay? You know it's held at 11, but you don't know how many are going to show up. Okay, some days there will be more, some days there will be less. So you don't exactly know all the parties who will be involved in that coordination or communication session. But you know when it is going to be held, which is why it's meeting oriented. Okay? And the last one is called generative communication. This is the most flexible and the most decoupled. Okay? This is decoupled in space, this is decoupled in time. Okay? This is also referred to as the blackboard architecture. Okay? So here you are communicating, okay, but you don't know who you are communicating with and when you will communicate with those entities. And the blackboard example is an easy one to understand. So this is the same, the analogy is you put up a flyer, okay, on a blackboard. So you want to basically broadcast a message to people saying, I want to sell my car because I'm graduating or some such thing. So you go and you post a note on the blackboard. Now you don't know who you're sending this message to. You know some people are going to see this, but you don't know who they are. So the recipients are unknown. Okay? And neither do you know when these recipients are going to see this message. Because some people may come at random points in time and see what is posted on your bulletin board and get your message. Okay? So decoupled in time, because you sent a message by posting it on a bulletin board, okay? But when people are going to take delivery of the message is unknown. Okay? So that's decoupled in time. Also, who's going to get this message is also unknown, because you don't know who is going to come and take delivery. Okay? So that's a good example of what is called generative communication. So what we are going to do today is look at this box, because we have seen this to some extent, we have seen that. Okay, but what we haven't looked at is how do you design this distributed application that are loosely coupled. Because this is an example of an application, okay, where you have this equivalent of a bulletin board. Applications or entities can post messages and some other entities can come at some later time and take delivery of arbitrary messages. So you are enabling communication, but you neither know who you are communicating with or when this communication or when a message will be delivered. Okay, so what models can we use, or what kinds of systems can we build with these models? Okay, so the way we'll do this is to do a case study rather than actually going and looking at how to design this. We'll just see one system that does this and try to understand how this is done. Okay, and this is basically a case study on Genie. Okay, Genie is basically a component on the Java framework. Okay, this is also called a coordination-based system. Okay, and the reason you want to be decoupled is Genie is designed for mobile devices that roam from one environment to another. Okay, so whenever an entity roams from one environment to another, you don't know what is available, what services are available in the new environment. Okay. So you cannot statically configure anything. You have to discover things on the fly. Okay? And that is basically at the core of Genie, which is by doing this, having this very flexible coordination model, you can enable discovery on the fly, okay? Discovering new services that become available. And the canonical example we are going to use is you want to print a document. Okay? And you want to print from your laptop. And you take a laptop, you come here, you are in the university environment, you take the laptop home, you are in some other environment, you may go to, let's say, Kinko's, which is yet another environment. And if you want to do this thing called print, you have to print to different devices, because in all of these environments, you will have different printers. You are not going to have the same one. Okay? And neither do you know what may be available or what may not be available. You should just show up at Kinko's, for example, and you want to print a poster. You don't know a priori what printer is going to be there in that store. You can't pre-configure it. You have to go there, discover it, and configure. So Genie allows you to automate this. You don't have to manually go and do this. But this is just one example of a service. In this case, it's a printing service that you have discovered on the fly. Okay? You could have arbitrary services that become available, and you are become aware of them. Okay, so this is effectively a distributed event notification system. Okay? And there are many other examples. Genie is just one example of this. Okay, if you use a Mac, okay, it has a service called Rendezvous, okay, which is a new name. I think it's called Bonjour these days. Okay. So this is also a discovery mechanism. Okay, what it does is it basically, whenever you go to an environment, it discovers all the devices or all the services that expose this interface. Printers is just one of them. It also discovers all of the other machines on your network, what printers are available. This is how it also discovers if other users are sharing iTunes libraries. So if you just share your library and there's some other machine on the network, your library automatically shows on iTunes in the other machine. Okay, so that basically involves a discovery mechanism. Okay, it's not pre-configured. You don't know who's sharing, what is being shared, but the machine has discovered this automatically. Okay, and all of this basically use some form of loosely coupled communication. Okay, now coming back to Genie, okay, so as I said, there are other systems, but we'll focus only on Genie today. Okay. So the way Genie implements this sharing is what is called a Java space. Okay. This is a shared tuple space. Okay. So this is like your bulletin board where you can post messages or flyers. Okay. This is in a tuple space, you can post tuples and some other entities can look for certain tuples and take delivery of these tuples. Okay. This is how you are going to enable communication. And each tuple is effectively a Java object. But for this purpose, this class, that doesn't really matter. Okay. So in some sense, this is also resembles our publish-subscribe paradigm that I introduced last time, and then we'll look at in more detail in the context of Genie. So here is your tuple space. This is your bulletin board. And there are publishers and there are subscribers. Publishers produce data items, okay, that they publish on this tuple space, and subscribers can query this tuple space. Okay, this is like a database. You don't know a priori what entities are posted on your bulletin board. You have to go and query. Say, is there someone selling a car? That's a query. That's basically, you can make a query and then your tuple space is going to run the query, find all matching tuples and return you all matching entries. Okay. So you can query or you can tell the tuple space that you are interested in all events of a certain kind or all tuples of a certain kind. So whenever something gets posted and it matches what you want, a notification is sent to you. Okay. This is how Genie works. Okay. So it is a form of a publish subscribe. Okay. And I'll show you the instantiation of this picture in the context of Genie. Okay. Same picture that I showed previously, but a more concrete version of this. Okay. So here are three distributed entities. Okay, that are communicating using this tuple space. Okay, which is like we call this a Java space. So this is the Java space. This is our shared bulletin board. And the first application has just written a tuple called A. Okay, and it is inserted into the Java space. There may be another tuple called A, which is fine. There may be multiple versions of these tuples. Okay, and here is another application that's written B. Okay. The third application comes and says, I want all tuples that match a certain condition T. Okay, this is a query that it's, so these two are writes, okay, this is a read. So you send off a query and this is the only tuple that matches it. So you could just read the tuple or you could read and delete the tuple. Okay, you can just go and pluck the flyer from the bulletin board if you are the intended recipient and you know this. Or you can just read it but leave the flyer there and let other people read it as it. Same model is true here. In this case, we are showing a scenario where you read a tuple and then you delete it. So it's gone from the tuple space. But you could just read but not delete. Okay. Now, how is this all implemented? Right? So that's what we look at next. So to enable this form of communication, Genie supports a number of services. Okay, just as Corba had all these services, we'll see similar services here. Okay, there's a transaction manager. This gives you a transactional semantics. Okay, because you are issuing queries and you are doing reads and writes on the tuple space. This is equivalent to some form of a database. Okay, so you may want to encapsulate these operations as transactions as you read and write, and this is why you have a transactional service. Because this is core Java, and then these are services that are layered on top of it. It has an event and notification service. This allows you to subscribe to certain types of tuples or get notifications. There could be leases and security if you want to encrypt your data and so on, or get lease and get notified for certain periods of time. So what this is showing is registering of a callback. In the previous case, I showed a query where you dynamically decide you want some tuples that matches criteria and take delivery. So you could do the same thing by a priori registering with the tuple spacing. Whenever someone inserts a tuple that matches this condition T, notify me. Yeah, rather than issuing a query, you basically just register your interest. This is you're subscribing to all tuples that will match T. And that's at some later point, if this application is inserted C, you're going to get a notification, and then you will do the same thing. You will read it or read and delete it. Okay. So there are several instantiations of Java spaces. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a few here. So the assumption, as you may recall, is that this is a distributed application. Okay? So you don't necessarily assume that your entire tuple space resides on one machine. Okay? The tuple space itself may be distributed across multiple machines, and then it's the responsibility of Genie to make sure that all queries and all of the reads and writes happen the way they are supposed to. Okay? So there are two variants we are going to talk about. In the first variant, what you have is a replicated tuple space. Okay, in this case, here are three machines, and the same tuple space is replicated on all three machines. Okay, whenever anything is posted on one, it becomes available on the other two as well. Okay, so here is a machine. So effectively, writes are broadcast to all replicas. Okay, that's what is being shown here. Here is a process that wants to write, but this write actually goes out to all of the replicas. So the replicas remain consistent with one another. Okay. So writes are more expensive, but reads could be local. Okay. Because if your tuple space actually has the tuple you want, then you can just read it locally because it's anyway replicated. Okay. Now, although reads are local, but if you're going to do read and delete, that cannot be local. Okay. Because if you delete it locally, you have to delete it globally. So this is showing an example where you read it and then you decide to delete the tuple. So then the take, what delete is called a take. Okay. A take message has to be sent to all of the other replicas saying remove this tuple, it's been deleted. Okay. Yes?
There is no master server kind of thing stored in tuple space. I mean, any replica can have the most
of it. Yeah. So the question is there a master? So this is loosely coupled. Very flexible distribution model. So there is no notion of a master in this case. Okay, all replicas are identical. You can do an operation anywhere, and then the Genie, the Java space implementation in Genie is going to take care of the broadcast consistency and so on for you. Okay, that's the assumption.
So one replica does not want to be holding tuple of a certain type, like it doesn't want to be bothered by that.
Yes. So I'll talk about, so you're asking what if you don't want certain types of tuples. So that's the other framework. So this is full replication. The other way is to partition the tuple space. Okay. So what is shown here is now again distribution. So Java space is distributed, but your different tuples are different machines. So this machine may have a bulletin board that stores all tuples that are, let's say, car ads, you want to sell cars. This may have all notices of talks in the department. Okay. Some other machine may store something else. So here you are partitioned your Java space saying these types of messages or tuples go on this machine. These types go here and the other goes there. So there's no replication, but there's distribution. So now reads and writes have to be handled differently in this case as opposed to the previous case. Okay. So here is an instance where you did a local write. Okay, and this write is not sent anywhere. It's basically just stored locally. So there's no other coordination involved. But reads have to be broadcast because you don't know where your tuple is going to be in your tuple space. So if you want to do a read, you have to broadcast that read and see which of these partitioned Java spaces has any matching entry. So you are sending queries everywhere. but writes could be local. Okay. They need not be local, but they could be local. Okay, because if the write you're doing, this tuple space doesn't want to accept the write, the same thing that you asked, then you have to send that write somewhere else, which is a tuple space that will accept a tuple of that type. So consistency has to be maintained as depending on how you do the distribution. Okay. So now assume that you have the Java space, okay, that allows you to store tuples, remove them. Now let's think, look at the big picture again. So effectively this is a discovery mechanism. Okay. So there's a lookup service that allows you to look things up on the fly, discover them, and so on. Okay. So tuple space has to have mechanisms to enable this. Okay, so here is the type of, so what this is shown here is the lookup service, what type of attributes can you store in a tuple. Okay, so here is the service ID, this is a service, these are attribute sets. So if you wanted to make a printer available, okay, using the Genie lookup service, you would basically say this basically is a printing service. Okay, you have the service ID saying printing service is so type some 100 or some such thing, and then you have the attribute set which describes what type of printer it is. Okay, so and then attributes could have different fields like service info. So this would be the name, the manufacturer, vendor, version number. This is the location of where the printer is, floor, room, building. Could add the address if you want, and so on. Okay, so this will so by posting a tuple of this form in your Java space, some other machine can come at some later point and say I need to print, and I want to print, let's say, to a color printer. This is your query. Yes, then you will go into the Java space and say, is there a color printer that has been posted into my Java space? Okay, then you do the right type of query. Okay, so you may want to basically have a printer type or some such thing, and then you get all matching entries and you return back to the user saying, here are the available color printers in this environment. And then you can pick one and print to it, yes.
So how do we identify which replicas to contact? When you have a query, you have to query the Java space. What do you mean by that? Like, you have to contact somebody, right? Who do we know? We go to an environment, how do we know
that? Right. So you have to discover the Java space. So we'll assume that the Java space is running on some well-known port. Okay, and then you will broadcast a message and say, where is this running? Okay, and then you will basically get it from there. Okay. Now, so there are various instances, and that's how you do it in Genie. So the basic assumption is basically there will be a Java space on most devices, effectively. Any laptop or any machine will have a Java space and it is making some services available. So by broadcasting it, you can discover, but it doesn't have to be that distributed. You could centralize it on some number of which. So the same question you would ask if you want to do DHCP, right? There's no pre-configured DHCP server. You discover it. So the same thing is actually done here. Any other questions here? So we'll talk about this, and then I'll just show some of the features in the Mac just to give you a flavor of how Rendezvous works in the Mac, which is a very similar discovery framework. Okay, so one last thing before I talk about that, which is this system called Lime. Okay, and that what this does is takes what Genie does one level further. Okay, so remember that we said all of this is relevant in mobile devices where devices come and go in different environments. If this is the case, the Java space, if there is a Java space running on each device, the Java space as a whole will keep changing depending on what machines are there in that environment and what machines are not. Okay. So what Lime does is it basically creates what is called a transient data space. Okay. So here the database that you query, okay, depends on what machines are in the environment at any given time. And once a machine joins, it basically joins its data space or tuple space to the rest. Okay, so now what this is showing are three laptops, okay, or three mobile devices that are connected by a wireless link. Okay, each has a local tuple space or a local data space, and when these three machines discover one another, they join their data spaces, so it looks like one larger database. Okay, and so basically any query is then dynamically sent to all of these machines, because it basically you can query the entire data space, that is the union of all the local data spaces, as a single entity, single logical entity. And if this machine or this laptop just goes away from the environment, this data space becomes unavailable. Okay. So what this system called LIME has added to this notion of data spaces is transience. Okay. So basically now the data space is not one database. What becomes available is also dependent on what devices are there in the system. And then whenever a device shows up, it takes all of its data space entries and it joins it with the rest, so that database becomes logically bigger. And when devices go, the data space shrinks. So that's the basic idea behind this transient sharing. Okay, so let me do a little bit of this demo.
How is the uniqueness of filing key ensured? Say, I have some other LIME system which created new tables.
So how is the uniqueness of primary key? So the nice thing about this is there shouldn't be a primary key. Right? So tuple space are just fields that you query on. So there is no notion of an index that is stored, which is why it is slow. Right? So basically, if you don't have an index, you'll have to do linear searches and so on. And you need to do this for flexibility reasons. Because if you define that your primary key is the printer type, and somebody wants to do something else, like they want to do it by model or something like that, or color or black and white, then when there's no easy way to join it, okay, then you get into all this mess. So the only thing to do is to assume that there is no predefined primary keys. These are just tuples with fields, and you can query. So then it's like doing matches by just doing linear searches. Okay, but that is what is required for flexibility reasons. Any other questions? So this is not a database in the strict sense. It's a data space, not a database. Okay, there's a difference. Right? It's called a data space. It's just a space that stores data. Okay, in a database, you have real structure and indices and so on. This resembles that, but is very different. And is also used in a very different way.
So even if they are replicas of particular information instance, it doesn't matter.
Yes. So you can. That's the reason I mentioned when you saw this picture that there are two instances of A, which is okay because this there may be multiple machines that hold this entry for the same printer, and that's fine. You don't have to have unique records or anything like that. You can publish the same information multiple times. It just so long as it's discoverable, that's all that matters. Okay, that is the reason there are these two instances here. Any other questions on this? Okay, so I want to show a little bit of let's see. Okay, so in I think they actually in our department they disable discovery mechanisms on the wireless interface. So what should have happened is actually if you go into the browser will discover stuff for you and automatically show you everything that's present. So if you click here, it actually shows you all the devices that it has discovered on the network. Okay, all of the machines, all of the printers and so on. And then you can pick and you can connect to it. Okay, so that's, but I guess it doesn't work here. Let me see if there is, at least it works for printers or maybe it doesn't. Really work on wireless interface, but let me just do one thing before I give up on the demo completely. So this is my desktop that I just connected to. Let's try the same thing here. The solution is almost invisible, but So this is not really visible, but let me try to see if I can make it bigger. How do I zoom into this? Cannot make it bigger, but I can read this for you. So these are all the printers actually to Discord. So that's this printers, and this is all the printers in the department that have advertised them. So these are all the wikis at Discord. So you can actually put up a wiki on a Mac and it gets shared automatically. So you can just click on it and you'll go to some wiki. So this is the first one, says CS Public. I don't know what this does, but let's try it. It doesn't connect to any of them. Okay, now it is connected to some. So anyway, so this is basically, so you don't really need to know a priori what is available, and it will discover this. So you can do the same thing with printers, just to give you an example. This is used to be called Rendezvous. It's now called Bonjour. For some trademark reasons, I think they changed the name. Okay, so we'll do printers. Suppose I want to add a printer, a new printer, and I don't know what printers are there, so I just do default. Should bring up a list. So you'll see that it says Bonjour here. So these are all the printers that have just gone in Discord. So you can click on one, or you can actually look at the information on before you click. So if you do. So what it also does is, now it is actually searching for drivers, because it doesn't know what printer it is. So once you click on a printer, it will go to that printer and say, what type of printer are you? Okay, so then it may say, I'm an HP, whatever, DeskJet printer, some model. Okay, so once it gets this information, then it goes and looks for a driver automatically, and then it configures the printer. So you don't really have to do anything like get a driver or figure out what type it is. All of this is automated because of the discovery service. For you. And there are similar variants of these mechanisms on other platforms. I'm just showing what you can get on the Mac. And same thing is true on iTunes. If you have iTunes on any platform, if you actually go and look for shared libraries, okay, it is also going to go and run the discovery protocol and get all of it. So what happens is each machine basically will publish its service in its tuple space, equivalent of a tuple space. And then anyone can then come and query and figure out. So that the browser I showed you was a union of all of the things that were discovered from all of the machines. Okay, when you look, try to add the printer, it only queried the printer field for in all of these tuple spaces, only showed you the list of matching printers it found, and so on. Okay, so it can basically do a whole bunch of these nice things for you. So in this case, the OS comes pre-configured with what you have to publish. Because there is something called MDNS. That's what it is using. The MDNS stands for multicast DNS. Okay. So there is something called an MDNS responder that is running on each machine. That is basically the daemon that is publishing your tuple space. Okay, so you can send an MDNS query. You can do all this on the command line, actually. I'm not going to show you all of that. But you can send off, just as you do a DNS lookup, you can do an MDNS lookup and say printer. Okay. So then this will go and talk to all of the MDNS responders that are on the network and say, I'm going to run this query and send me all matching entries. Okay. So then all of these entries come back to you. And then you show up the list. So that's basically what is happening. Very similar to Genie. This is not a Genie implementation, incidentally. It's just a different implementation of a system that does similar things for you. Okay? Question? Okay. So, yes, so on the wireless interface, I think they have disabled it to remove cross traffic, because there's a lot of broadcasts happening in discovery and that will clutter up the wireless network, so they don't allow this on the wireless. They drop all MDNS packets at the base station. But on a wired network, you will actually see all of this. So anyway, that's the quick sort of demo to show you, give a flavor for this. So let's just stop here for today. So just as a reminder, two more classes. Yes, one on sensor networks and one on mobile or multimedia systems that are coming up. And as far as the book is concerned, we are really done. Okay, we did like 400 or 500 pages worth of material already.